Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
You're listening to Campus Killings, brought to you by Abject Entertainment. Be sure to check out some of the other great true crime podcasts from this network, including The Murder in My Family,
DNA ID, Zodiac Speaking,
Scene of the Crime, Missing Persons,
Beyond Bizarre True Crime,
and Citizen Detective. All of these podcasts are available for you to binge on right now, wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe where you're listening to this podcast so you don't miss an episode.
Today's episode takes us to the 1800s. While we normally don't cover such old cases because so much about the criminal justice system has changed with the advent of DNA and other methods, I wanted to touch on this case because it brings up some interesting points about criminal confessions, reward incentives, and just how much the criminal justice system has changed in the last century. I'd also like to give a thank you and shout out to our listeners, Leah and Kayla, for alerting us to this interesting case.
Oh.
I also want to give a little love to Abby, who also works on this podcast with us, because she provided some amazing historical context for today. All right, so before we get to the story, let me introduce you to the college where it all happened. At the time of our story, the Centenary Collegiate Institute was a co-ed college in Warren County, New Jersey. Founded in 1867 by the United Methodist Church, the school's co-ed option is quite surprising, as most formal schools of the 1800s were either single-gendered or only for boys, so the school was very much ahead of its time. The school had changed several times over history, becoming a girls-only preparatory school in the early 1910s and then a women's college in the 1970s before going co-ed again as a four-year college in 1988. As of 2016, Centenary is now a university offering undergraduate and advanced degrees in everything from accounting and fashion design to applied studies and environmental science. But our story takes place in 1886, when the campus was still known as the Centenary Collegiate Institute. In the 1880s, Hackettstown, New Jersey, where Centenary is located, was a booming town making its money off tourism from the elite of New York and Pennsylvania, who flocked to the town in the summers for recreational activities around the Muscatong River. Its proximity to the Morris Canal, along with the Warren Eyre Foundry, also made Hackettstown an ideal place for industry and educational opportunities. The Collegiate Institute was Hackettstown's crown jewel, anchoring the town limits on its furthest side, surrounded by farms, picket fences, and tree-lined roadways. About five blocks from the town center, the open campus included a center building for administrative offices, classrooms, and student and staff dormitories.
You know that I live like 20 minutes from Hackettstown, right? And that was one of the places that we looked for a house.
Oh, I didn't realize it's close to the Pennsylvania border.
Yeah, it's very close. Huh. I pass through it every time I come home from school.
I did not know that, Megan.
I just love when I'm familiar with the actual places we discuss on this show. A lot of the cases that we covered are local to us.
Yes, actually, a little selection bias there, maybe.
Probably.
So the town itself may have been what we might think of today as like a resort town, but the farmland outside of the town was a different story. Earning a living off the land was difficult in the Victorian period, and many farm families struggled to support themselves. There also weren't a ton of opportunities for children of lower income parents, and many had to leave their families and farms to find work elsewhere. Tilly Smith was one of those children. Matilda, or Tilly, as she liked to be called, was born in a small village called Byram, about 6 miles outside of Hackettstown. Her date of birth is questionable. Some sources say 1865, while some say 1868. Her parents, Nathan and Sarah Smith, had three daughters and a son, and Tilly was the second to youngest child. I couldn't find much about her childhood, probably because the case is so old, but since the Byram area was mostly farms in the 1800s, we can assume that Tilly's family were farmers. In the winter of 1885, when she was either 17 or 19, depending on her birth year, Tilly left her family to look for work in Hackettstown, and she found some. She was hired as a kitchen worker, and actually some sources refer to her job as a potato peeler, for the Centenary Collegiate Institute, and along with her job, she was also supplied with room and board.
Oh, okay.
While we don't know if Tilly was hoping to one day be a student at the Institute herself, or if she was just sending money back to her family, we do know that despite her mature decisions to find gainful employment, she wasn't much different than other young adults today. Tilly liked to go out, and she wasn't much for following rules, and this would become an issue quickly at her new job. There was a very strict 10 p.m. curfew for all female staff who were boarding on campus, and if they wanted to stay out after 10 p.m., they had to get written permission from the matron in charge of room and board. Again, we're talking the 1800s. Notice I said only women had a curfew.
I did notice that, very much so, very clearly.
Mm-hmm. According to some accounts, Tilly had been unsuccessful in getting the matron to grant her permission to stay out on the town past curfew. So when her friends invited her out to a concert in Hackettstown on the night of April 8th, 1886, she had no intentions of asking permission to stay out late. Instead, she asked the maintenance man, James Titus, if he would help her out and unlock the boarding house's basement for her when she returned so that she could get into her room. But
she's clever.
Very clever, but James had been working at the Institute for over a decade, and he was very aware of the 10 p.m. curfew rule. But when he told her that she had to ask the matron for permission, she said that she'd rather stay out all night than ask for permission. James would later recall that he didn't think she was being serious, so he just shrugged it off and dropped the subject. As you could guess, his response didn't deter Tilly, though, and that evening after her shift was over in the kitchen, she met three of her friends at Shields Hall Theater in Hackettstown to watch a show called The Fitzpatrick Merrymakers. During the show, Tilly and her friends met two out-of-town salesmen who were staying at the hotel across the street. The men talked to the girls during intermission as well as after the show and later escorted them out of the theater. Now, I do want to take a minute here to explain some basic Victorian social rules so we can understand what happens next. In the Victorian period, unless they were poor and working class, women of any age were rarely seen in public without the company of a male escort. And in many instances, if a woman had to walk alone, she was seen as putting herself in a bad position and was socially responsible for anything bad that may happen to her. Just like we have issues with predatory men in 2023, the Victorian period was fraught with predatory behavior and was all the worse because the social structures of the day encouraged men to be sexually aggressive and violent.
And then blame the women for this aggression after.
Exactly.
Frankly, has been a theme, you know, that you still observe at current time.
Yep. And the general Victorian feelings about female safety was simply that a woman would be safe if she were in the company of a man, or right, not in a place where violence could be done to her, like out on the town and late at night. So again, all about blaming the victim, right?
Yes.
The fact that Tilly had gone to a show at night in town with just her friends was a bold choice for a Victorian social conventions. Now, what happens next has conflicting sources, though most agree that as Tilly, her friends, and their two male escorts walked out onto Hackettstown Main Street, Tilly was approached by her ex-boyfriend, a young man named Fred Weedy. The nature of their relationship and its demise is lost to history, but some sources say that Frank and his friends insulted Tilly and tried to start an altercation with the two businessmen. However, other sources say that Tilly initiated a conversation with Frank when she saw him crossing the street. So, Megan, it's unclear what exactly the interaction was, but whether it was an uncomfortable altercation with an ex-boyfriend or simply social conventions, one of the men, Charles Munich, offered to walk Tilly back to the Collegiate Institute since it was dark out.
Okay.
By the time they arrived at Tilly's boarding house, it was after 10 o'clock and the doors were locked. Charles told Tilly that he'd be happy to bring her back to his hotel and pay for her to have a room for the night, but she declined, saying that she would just try to break into the laundry room.
I like her. She's funny. clearly not a rule follower. I'll just break into the laundry room.
But also, you know, it's interesting. Like, would, you know, she'd rather risk being alone than getting a hotel for the night. But, you know, I don't know if it's because, again, the Victorian times, like, what would it seem like if she went to the hotel with this man she just met? So we're not really, I'm not too sure about, you know, what the times were like. But either way, she went towards the Institute and Charles left to walk back to his hotel. In the early morning of April 9th, 1886, a man named Mr. White was letting his dog frolic in one of the fields near the Institute. His dog became incredibly interested in something in the high grass, and when he went to investigate, what he found was shocking. A young woman lay on her back, one arm outstretched, legs folded to the side, her eyes staring glassily. But the worst part was that Mr. White recognized the woman. It was Tilly Smith. He had seen her around campus on his daily walks. He ran back to town to get authorities and detectives known as Pinkertons at the time, and they went to the site to investigate.
Oh, sorry, is this Pinkerton's investigation? Like the famous private investigators?
Yes, I think so, Megan, because there was a newspaper article citing that Newark actually supplied the detectives for this case and that their lead detective was chief of detectives for all of New Jersey. So it's likely that neither Hackettstown nor Warren County had their own investigators. So they went to this central group of investigators.
Interesting.
As they inspected the body, they found that Tilly had harsh red bruises around her neck, another bruise on her forehead, and her clothing was covered in dust. Investigators were quick to determine her death a homicide and one that had not taken place in the field. Due to the dust on her clothing, they speculated that she had been murdered in the Collegiate Institute's barn not far from where her body was found. The doctor who performed her autopsy determined that she had been killed via strangulation between 6 to 7 hours before she was discovered, so that would put it at about 1 or 2 in the morning.
This is basically when she's coming back and trying to break into campus.
Remember, she was coming back a little after 10, so there's a little time.
All right.
But again, we're talking about the 1800s. Who knows how accurate the timeline is for time of death.
Mm-hmm.
The doctor also said, quote, she had been outraged by more than one person while she was in her death struggle. So in Victorian language, outrage had a different connotation than we'd use today. In the 1800s, an outrage meant an act of violence. So in context, this is saying that Tilly was violently attacked by more than one person as she died.
Oh, I see. Okay. So why did they think that there was more than one person? What evidence did they have?
Basically, it was just the level of defensive bruising to her body, as well as the large amount of semen inside of her. These two facts led them to believe that the attack had been done by more than one man. So not very scientific.
Okay. Well, they're working with what they have at the time.
Exactly. The doctor also could not determine if she had been sexually assaulted or engaged in consensual sex.
I mean, okay, but there's a large amount of semen in her right around her time of death, and she's got signs of a struggle. So I'm going to conclude that this is a sexual assault one way or the other.
I would agree. Now, since there were no drag marks around Tilly's body, detectives felt that two men had assaulted and killed her and then hauled her body to the field to dump her. Now, the first obvious two suspects were those two traveling salesmen who had met Tilly the night of the show. But while they were imprisoned for several days and severely questioned, there were numerous eyewitnesses who had seen the men drinking at the bar inside their hotel late into the night from April 8th to April 9th. And without any other evidence, they were released from jail and released from, frankly, being suspects. Now, obviously, we have current laws around imprisonment during police investigation and, you know, what kind of evidence they would need to hold people. Again, this is a different time. It's not surprising that they were held for several days.
Right.
In an era before DNA, surveillance, and forensics, detectives really had nothing to go off of but eyewitness accounts and the physical evidence they found at the scene, which unfortunately for them was just Tilly's body and the clothing that she was wearing when she was found.
And now, a brief word from our sponsors.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress-them-on-the-third-date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Murder in this small tourist neighborhood was exceedingly rare, and Tilly's death became not only front page news for Hackettstown, but also for New York City, Philadelphia, and Trenton. Tilly quickly became a symbol for the brutal defilement of female purity and virtue, and after it was discovered that the Smith family could not afford to pay for her funeral, and that Tilly had been buried in a potter's field, the people of Hackettstown raised funds to build a memorial for her.
Oh, that's nice.
And I didn't know this, but potter's fields were basically mass graves for poor people that bore no headstones or markers. Articles were published almost daily speculating about the crime, who the murderer could be, and crying out for justice on Tilly's behalf. Several New York and Philadelphia papers latched on to the maintenance man, James Titus, citing him as an excellent suspect since he had been the only person on campus to know that Tilly would be returning after curfew. I want to read you parts of one article in particular from the Philadelphia Times. It's pretty interesting. Now, this is from May 1st, and this is about 3 weeks after the murder. And it's titled, "The Evidence Against Titus." This is what it says. Detective Bob Haggerty of Newark was one of the first persons who suspected janitor Titus of being connected with Tilly Smith's murder, either as principal or accessory. He thinks Titus did it himself. He let Tilly in the basement and told her to sit down while he banked his fires and he would light her upstairs. Detective Haggerty thinks she sat down and while waiting, the janitor made his proposals, which were rejected. He then knocked her down by striking a blow on each temple. The girl recovered partial consciousness and threatened to tell the institute's president when Titus began choking her to compel her to promise not to tell. Before he knew it, the detective thinks, he had choked the girl to death. He had all night before him and took his time planning what to do with the body. He probably walked around the main building several times until he was sure all the lights were out, and then he carried the body to the spot where it was found the next morning. And the article ends with the phrase, "the theory generally shared." I mean, this is absurd. You would not see this today.
Well, no, not supported by no evidence. How did they know she was going to ask him to let her back in?
I'm assuming he told them. That's the only way we would know.
Yeah, I mean, obviously she didn't, so I was wondering if it was a friend or if it was him.
I don't know. I would assume it was him because I guess if he had nothing to hide, why would he not say that?
That's what I was just going to say. If he was guilty, in fact, I doubt that he'd be revealing that information.
But it's unbelievable that a lead detective would go on the record saying he probably did this and probably thought about this, and it's all based on nothing, right?
Yeah, no, there's no evidence to support that whatsoever.
At least we can say journalism has come a long way, although we still see a lot of issues with the media and how they report crime. Certainly, we would not see this today.
Well, you also can't. I mean, you can't smear someone like this.
Well, it would be defamation, right?
There would be legal issues, so that I'm sure were not present then as well.
Yeah. Okay, so was it possible or likely for James to have killed Tilly? Well, James was a married man with a baby daughter who lived in town. And at the time of Tilly's murder, he was 29 years old and described as a quiet, small man who had few friends outside of his family, but he was a good provider. He had also worked for the Institute for about a decade, and by all accounts, he was an upstanding family man. Initial investigations also proposed that Tilly had been murdered in the barn near where her body had been found, and James did not work up at the barn. Remember, he worked in the Institute's basement tending to the boilers. But regardless, Tilly's story became a media storm that put a ton of pressure on detectives working the case. Everyone wanted them to make an arrest. The town even advertised a $1,000 reward, which would be over $30,000 today, for anyone with information on who the murderer was. And the reward did get them a lead, as it usually would, Megan. A lead that agreed with the newspapers that James Titus was indeed the murderer.
Well, that's not surprising. I mean, you know, he's already the suspect. It's almost like labeling theory. And, you know, he's already been kind of stigmatized. So I'm not surprised that someone gave information about him.
Yep. And this informant was a seminary student at the Collegiate Institute who worked part-time for the school as a janitor. His name was William Mead, and he contacted detectives and said he had evidence that James Titus was the killer.
I love to hear what this evidence is.
I don't even know if you could call it evidence, but here we go. Oh. William claimed that on the very night Tilly had been killed, he and James had been working in the Institute's basement, and James had said some lewd comments about Tilly, including things like, quote, "Tilly is the kind of girl one could have a racket with if he wanted," as well as telling William to wait in the basement with him instead of going back to his dorm because, quote, "Tilly is coming in late, she will be alone, and then we can pump her." So what do these Victorian things mean? You could probably figure it out, but a racket was Victorian slang for illicit activities. And for the second comment, sexually promiscuous women were referred to as the town water pump, so the comment to pump her was slang for having sex.
Understood.
This tip and the fact that James spent much of his time in the sooty basement tending to the coal boilers led detectives to believe that the dust found on Tilly's clothes was not from the straw and animal bedding that they initially thought, but from the coal, and that it was very probable that James Titus had raped and strangled Tilly in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with no other evidence to go on, and the public demanding an arrest, detectives arrested James Titus at his home in downtown Hackettstown on April 29th, 1886, for the rape and murder of Tilly Smith.
With no evidence.
And I'm not sure that this would meet the probable cause burden for an arrest today, that they're going on such little. They have, of course, there's no physical evidence, no DNA or forensics of the time. So it led me to think of just how many cases there probably were of wrongful convictions, you know, during this Victorian period.
Just reminds me of, you know, the Salem witch trials. Point a finger.
Yep. I thought of that, too, as I was reading it. So James Titus went to trial, and it began on September 28, 1886, and lasted for several weeks. The prosecution brought in 60 witnesses to testify on everything from the autopsy to Tilly's work ethic, but their major witness was William Meade. On the stand, he restated the lewd comments James had allegedly made about Tilly the night of the murder, as well as providing the jury copious notes that he had taken of James's movements and conversations he had with other staff members after Tilly's body was found. In the Philadelphia Times, William was quoted as saying that on Monday night following Tilly's murder, William and James were in the boiler room around midnight, and James allegedly became nervous and his face drained of color before he stated, quote, "Well, they may arrest me and they may hang me, but they can't destroy my soul."
Oh, jeez.
William also wrote a secret statement that he would not disclose the details of to the press, but that, quote, "Awakening at between 11:30 and 12, he hastily went at once to the basement, creeping noiselessly, for fear of arousing anyone. In the basement, he saw a horrible sight and slipped away to his room again, unobserved by anyone. Just what the student saw, he refuses to reveal until he comes before the jury." Now, it's important to remind everyone here that William did not submit anything to the police until after a local newspaper posted that $1,000 reward.
Mm-hmm.
Despite William Meade's testimony, James had a good defense lawyer and an incredibly experienced attorney named J.G. Shipman. Prior to that, Shipman had tried to challenge the indictment on grounds of technicality, but he was overruled. During the trial, he took the stand that James Titus would have been incapable of committing the crime for several reasons. First, James was a small man and suffered from illness that often made him feel weak, and Tilly was both heavier and taller than James. He also said that if Tilly had been killed in the basement, James would have had to have carried her body, which would have been dead weight, over 400 yards to drop her in the field. And just for reference, that would be the equivalent of about 3 football fields.
So that's a good point. That's a good one right there, the actual carrying. Yeah.
He claimed that James could not have accomplished this without dragging Tilly, and there were no drag marks at the scene. I, too, think that's a good point.
Yes.
Shipman also had 4 doctors testify that while Tilly's body did contain semen, there were no signs of a sexual assault. So even if James and Tilly had been in a sexual relationship, there's no proof that he had raped her. Which I agree as well. While the prosecution had made several claims that James had often had issues of bad conduct with female staff at the Institute, they had no witnesses to testify to this, and there was absolutely no evidence to show that James was sexually deviant or sexually motivated.
Okay.
And lastly, the original autopsy findings suggested, again, that there had been 2 men who murdered Tilly, not 1. Shipman also tried to discredit William Meade, citing that he was not well-liked on campus for being pompous and self-righteous, and forcing everyone to call him Reverend, even though he was still a seminary student. But Shipman's efforts did not stop William Meade or the media storm that exploded during the trial. Newspaper headlines declared, "Janitor Titus grows haggard, and is he weakening?" And again, these were all over the tri-state area. James also became very sick during the trial from both his own usual health problems and from the emotional stress of being on trial. Actually, at one point, he collapsed in court and had to be carried out.
Do you know what his health problem was, or that wasn't really described?
That wasn't described, no.
Okay.
Due to his illness, he chose not to testify during trial, which newspapers reported as incriminating. Again, this sounds ridiculous to us because we know that most defendants don't testify on their own behalf. But again, during this time, that was seen as a sign of guilt.
Yes. Okay.
Despite Shipman's best efforts, the jury was very swayed by William Meade's testimony, and they delivered a verdict of guilty on all charges. 3 months later, a Warren County judge sentenced James Titus to death by public hanging, and the date was set for April 14th, 1887.
Wow, really? Okay.
During his sentencing, the judge asked James if he had anything to say, and after expressing that he'd wish he'd been healthy enough to take the stand and defend himself, he said, quote, "They tried me in absence and falsely convicted me of a crime of which I declare here and now, in the presence of this court and my countrymen who hear me, that I am not guilty. And I most humbly ask the court to spare my feelings by sentencing me in as few words as possible, as nothing the court can say about the crime of which I am convicted can apply to me. As I solemnly repeat, I am not guilty of it." The judge was unmoved by his words, citing that James had no way of escaping death unless he would confess to the crime.
He would escape death by confessing?
Yeah, again, different time. At this time, the judge was saying, if you confess, then you won't get death. But as we see sometimes, people who are innocent, if we assume James is innocent, he'd rather die than take the fall for something he didn't do.
Right. I mean, I guess I was just surprised to hear the trade-off, though, because in that era, if you confessed, usually you were spared a painful death.
Yes.
Maybe it was a quicker death, mm-hmm. but not spared the death penalty. Okay.
Attorney Shipman filed an appeal of James's case, but he was unsuccessful in overturning the jury's verdict, and James remained on the 19th century equivalent of death row. However, the tide of public opinion quickly swung towards James's favor after the sentencing, with several petitions sent to the judge signed by prominent members of the Hackettstown community. And some of these signatures even included men who had sat on his jury.
Oh, so they believed in his guilt, but not in his punishment?
Exactly. So the petitions, it was twofold. So they were, part of it was that they were saying that the case was largely circumstantial, but also because of his health, they were saying that his sentence should be downgraded to life in prison because of his health both before and during the trial.
Okay.
It's interesting that even members of his own jury were going back on their original thoughts and now saying that maybe he should be spared. I don't think we see that often. Every now and then you'll see that in high-profile cases, jurors coming forward, but most of the time they're not going to change their initial verdict.
They come forward after when they find out things that they didn't know, and then you'll hear a juror say, "If I had that information, I would have come to a different decision." But it doesn't seem like that was the case here, just more of a sympathy yep. towards him.
We'll return after a brief word from our sponsors.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Much to the shock of the Hackettstown community and the press, James Titus filed a formal confession with the Warren County Court a few months before his scheduled hanging. Now, of course, it's up for debate whether he decided to confess in order to get a downgraded sentence or if he was actually fessing up to the crime. But I'm interested to hear what you think. So let me tell you what the confession said.
Okay.
Now, he professed that he and Tilly had been having sexual relations since she'd been hired at the school, and that when she came back late on April 8th and found herself locked out, he let her into the basement and they had consensual sex. After they were done, James says that he told Tilly, but after they were done, James said that Tilly told him that she thought she was pregnant and that if it turned out that she was, she would expose him as the father. Then they began arguing, and during the argument, he says he strangled Tilly and killed her, but he had not intended to do so. By the time he realized he'd gone too far, she was already dead. All right, so what do we think about this confession based on what else we know about the case?
I think it's fictional. I think it's just completely made up.
Yeah.
And I have to imagine at that point he was afraid for his life, or there was another incentive for him to confess. And we know that innocent people confess.
I mean, I think that's the ultimate incentive, right? To live. He was probably, as it was getting closer and closer to his date, he probably was getting nervous and, you know, he confessed. And, you know, the confession did commute his sentence from death to a life sentence, but it was a life sentence of hard labor. Right. So we're not talking about just not like any life sentence is easy, but this is like still a very brutal sentence. And then the tide of public opinion did a complete 180 again.
Well, because now that he's confessed, they're like, wow, he was guilty. Yep. People, you know, we still have trouble recognizing that innocent people confess now. So
yes.
I could understand at the time how people thought this was indicative of his guilt. And they were probably they felt a little betrayed for supporting him.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, this was a big deal. His confession was printed in the paper, and many of the petition signers now found themselves in a terrible place because not only had many prominent citizens been defending a confessed killer, but the memorial to Tilly that claimed she died in defense of her honor may not have been true at all, because Tilly may not have been the paragon of virtue and purity that she was made out to be. Now, this is obviously not to say that the fact that she may have enjoyed sexual activity means that she deserved a horrible end, but I bring this up to showcase the fallibility of the court of public opinion and the danger the press can be to cases with such little evidence. So now, you know, Tilly's being looked at because of his confession, she's no longer seen as a victim. She's seen as a woman who's not pure.
Yes, this is a unit that I'll be covering in my media and crime class as well. It's like virtuous victims.
Mm-hmm.
We expect our victims to be perfect
yep.
victims and not flawed or just regular people.
Now, what if instead of James Titus, the press had chosen Tilly's ex-boyfriend, Frank Weedy, as a possible murderer? Now, would this outcome have been similar? Would the detective had found evidence that would have made him look guilty? I mean, as I said before, in an era without DNA or forensics, we can never know for sure if James Titus confessed to save himself from being executed for a crime he didn't commit, or if he had murdered her and he was clearing his conscience. I think we're both in the same boat here, thinking that it seems more likely that this was a false confession, but obviously there's really no way to know.
It doesn't seem like there's any evidence really to support his story or an alternative
yeah.
theory, but it also seems his story seems made up to me. There are elements that don't seem to fit at all.
Mm-hmm.
And without any other corroborating evidence, I really believe that it's fictional.
Because remember, the doctor who did the autopsy felt pretty certain that there were two people involved. But in this confession, he never says there was anyone else there with him either. So that's
right.
Interesting.
Right.
Okay, so while James Titus did escape death, he did 19 years of hard labor in a prison camp before being paroled for good behavior in 1904. However, he never saw his wife again, as she died only 1 month before his parole was granted.
Oh.
After 19 years, Hackettstown had all but forgotten about James Titus, the supposed murderer, and he moved back into his old house with his grown daughter. James continued living a quiet life in Hackettstown until his death in 1952 at the age of 95. That's very old for 1952.
Whoa.
Yeah. He was buried in Union Cemetery in Hackettstown, which ironically is the same place as Tilly Smith's memorial. According to those who knew him, he never spoke of Tilly Smith's murder case after the trial. While all that is left of Tilly and James's stories are the headstones and old newspaper articles, the murder and subsequent trial still loom large in many local citizens' minds. Over the years, writers, journalists, and local historians have all agreed that James Titus was probably an innocent man and that Tilly's murderer walked free. One local man, Eric Anderson, who is a trained sociologist and local historian, truly believes in James Titus's innocence and has worked for over a decade to get him posthumously pardoned. Mm-hmm. In an interview he did with NJ.com, Anderson pointed to several witness statements from a newspaper in 1886 that showed many townspeople were skeptical about his guilt even before the trial began. In reading over the trial transcripts and other court documents, Anderson feels that the prosecution ran out of leads quickly, but were pressured by the press to pin the murder on someone, even if the evidence wasn't there. In 2009, Anderson set a petition to then-Governor Corzine of New Jersey to get an exoneration for James Titus, but he was unsuccessful. Anderson also has a blog called The Free James Titus Project for anyone who would like to check out his work.
Wow.
Two authors have also dissected the Tilly Smith murder through a more modern criminal justice lens. There is a nonfiction book called In Defense of Her Honor, The Tilly Smith Murder Case by Dennis Sullivan, and a work of fiction called The Cemetery Keeper's Wife by Mary Ann McFadden. While we can never know for sure if James was innocent or guilty, I think what we can take away from this case is that the media and the court of public opinion can sometimes play a dangerous role in the world of criminal justice. And in fact, if James was innocent, it means that Tilly's killer went on to live a life without consequence for many, many years. For any of our listeners who may live in New Jersey, Centenary University hosts a Tilly Walk to keep Tilly's memory alive. If you want to know more about Tilly or to walk the areas where she walked, you can check out Centenary Stage Company to see when their next Tilly Walk is scheduled. And if you're interested in learning more about wrongful convictions, you can check out the Innocence Project at innocenceproject.org. Before we go today, if you'd like to support Campus Killings, consider subscribing to the show with an Abjack Insider subscription through Apple Podcasts.
Your subscription will get you VIP access to all the shows on the network that not only includes hundreds of episodes of ad-free listening, but also bonus content and early access to episodes.
For only $4.99 a month or $49.99 a year, you'll unlock a variety of listener benefits and you'll be supporting this show in the process.
Head over to Apple Podcasts and search for either Campus Killings or Abjack and you can start your subscription with a free trial.
Your support is greatly appreciated.
Thank you everyone for listening today and we hope you'll join us on the next episode of Campus Killings.
Campus Killings is hosted by Dr. Megan Sachs and Dr. Amy Schlossberg, with research and writing by Abigail Belcastro. It's produced by Mike Morford of Abjack Entertainment. Be sure to follow Campus Killings on social media. You can find Campus Killings on Twitter with the handle @CampusKillings or on Facebook at facebook.com/CampusKillings. You can also visit the show's homepage at campuskillings.com. Be sure to tune in every other Saturday for new episodes of Campus Killings.